Hello and welcome to another episode of the Give Us A Spell podcast. My name's Zach, I'm your host, and this show we're going to be getting in, we're having two Toms in. Tom, my regular guest with me, and also Tom Waterhouse. Now, Tom is a pretty unique figure in the racing and betting game. He's done a lot, and he's still a pretty young fella. He's got some unique marketing that he's putting out lately with his when he's holding animals and he's got the girls with him and he's drinking his Fanta and he's up and go. It's very unique. It gets people talking. Obviously, not everyone's cup of tea, but we're going to get him on and see what's actually got him to this point. He was, when he left school, his mum is a professional horse trainer. She's one of the greatest of all time. Doesn't bet at all, and his old man, he's a punter, and then people know his grandfather as well. So getting into the game as a bookie, starting his own bookmaking service, selling it off, and then becoming TomWaterhouse.com now with his tipping service and odds rater and everything. So it's going to be a really interesting chat, so let's get him on. We'll welcome in Tom Waterhouse.
All right, welcome in, Tom. How are you?
Yeah, really good. Really good words. Thanks for having me on the show.
Mate, what's been happening? Is it a bit of a weird time for you? Like, I know COVID's sort of getting a little bit better, I guess, in these days.
Yeah, look, it's been obviously strange. But in Sydney, as you guys know, we've sort of been quite lucky in that there's been somewhat a normal life in terms of being able to get to work and do like the normal stuff around the city. And the kids' school was disrupted for a bit last year, but sort of back to normal. We've got three young kids, so they've just been keeping us busy. So I feel lucky, obviously, compared to how it's been in some of the other states and other parts of the world. But yeah, it's obviously different, but nowhere near the impact that other people have had.
So a good question with that, like, you've got three young kids. How many are at school?
So we've got all three of them are at somewhat sort of school now. Like, our three-year-old, she's at like preschool, and son's in kindergarten, and daughter, yeah, she's in year three.
It's good when I used to be a school teacher, and I still do. I'm a high school teacher, but I still do bits of like 1 or 2 days a week, you know, casually and whatnot. And it's good when we've had guests on in the past, and they've gone. They can always, their teacher's got such an easy job. It's such a piss take. It's whatever. They get all these holidays. And then all of a sudden when there was the homeschooling and all of a sudden they had to start doing the maths and the stuff you haven't done in 20 years, it's a bit of a learning curve.
Yeah, well, even the homework, my daughter's in year three and they give her all the homework for the week and she had a whole bunch of other stuff on, so she decided to do it. She's doing an hour and a half homework. She's seven, you know? Like, I'm like, oh, my God.
You weren't doing that in
an hour and a half homework. Yeah. And, but, yeah, they a lot of homework and the homeschooling. Obviously, my wife actually did it all. So, but it's a big job and a huge responsibility for teachers, isn't it? It's they're bringing up the future, like, leaders and people in the workforce and the people in society. It's a big job because they're molding those kids. You know, it's a big task.
And how did you find it with last year, Tom? Because the racing sort of didn't stop. The way we were one lucky industry that kept going the whole way through. So we've all still had to do our job. Right, Zach and I had to keep going into work and but still adapt around what this new world looks like.
Yeah, I feel so sorry for some of the industries that ground to a halt, and they're still ground to a halt, because I know when they called off the racing in Victoria, I don't know if you remember, but like, they called it off for maybe 2 days. And I at that point I was like, oh my gosh, it's going to get, the industry will stop, you know? And then we sent an email out to all our members just going, look, it looks like the racing industry is not continuing for a period. Your membership's on hold. And I'm like, oh, what are we going to do, you know? And luckily the racing industry and they did as an industry such a great job to be able to keep things going and do it safely. And our business and the others in the racing industry is able to continue. So I feel very fortunate and obviously feel for the people that weren't in that situation. I can only imagine how tough it is.
That's right. So, mate, what we do, what we try and do is try and have a go through, I guess, your life. But what I want to first start on is what you've been doing lately, and what most people are talking about is your unique marketing strategy, which I love. Yeah. To me, you watch it and you go, I have no idea why he's holding that, why she's there, and what that drink's for. Is it just to sort of get people talking? So what's the go?
So look, marketing, the way we look at it, there's no point marketing unless you have something that you think is going to be a great product and something that people want. Because if you market just rubbish, well, you might get people to look at your thing, but you're going to get no return. And so we always think about marketing is really like, and having a brand is a promise kept. You've got to deliver on what you've got and deliver on what you're saying that you have. And but it's very hard, even if you've got the greatest product, to get people to look at it, because everyone's so busy, you know, like they've got the next thing, whether it's on Instagram or Twitter or TikTok, and they're flicking, and they're like, well, even if you have got a great product, I just can't be bothered to look at it, and I do this already. And so you've got to create something that gives them interest. Well, what's that about? Or yeah, what is that? Or why is someone doing that? And the thing that's really interesting is that when we were at TomWaterhouse.com the first time, and then William Hill was spending huge money, tens of millions of dollars on marketing here in Australia. And a lot of it to begin with was on TV. And we used to have focus groups, and they were the most interesting thing. You'd play like your ad or what you were thinking of doing to these focus groups and get their feedback and hope that that small group of 10, 20, 30 people would give an insight into what your demographic were after in an ad and what they would find interesting. But the thing that's so amazing about now on social media and using likes of Facebook and TikTok and LinkedIn is that you get to see in real time the data and analytics of how your ad and what's interesting to consumers, and when they churn off the ad and when they stop watching it and when they share it and when they talk about it or comment, and you actually see what works for your demographic right then. Right now, we know if we release an ad, if it's a stinker, yeah, because Facebook's or like automated algorithms or whatever either like hide it in the feed or they promote it. And so that feedback loop of what's interesting to your demographic and is so quick. And what we try and do is just make content that is interesting for our demographic and our viewers and people that are interested in what we're doing. And if stuff works, we try and build on that and develop it and make it better. And if stuff doesn't work, then we don't, you know, we go, well, look, that we thought that'd be, there's so many things we've done that we go, oh, this is going to be so funny. And it just falls completely flat. We're about to release these whole new ads this weekend. And one of the ads I thought was going to be so good, we've just watched it in the office and literally not one person laughed. Yeah. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's a stinker.
See, and yeah, I love that. But when you have these sort of, like you just said, yeah, focus groups, are you doing the same thing now? You're all just getting together and talking and saying, you know, is
we do now is just try and be far quicker in our cycle of, like, so we used to maybe do an ad once every half, like at TomWaterhouse.com the first time. And that ad might last for 6 months, maybe even a year, a set of creative. And we'd have the same ad playing on for so long, and just every when there was a break in the NRL or the tennis or whatever, up would come the same 15-30 second ad, and people go, oh look, I've seen that for a year now, but I guess that's all I get to see and I have to watch it. We try and basically churn out new creative on a week by week or month by month basis, and if something's worth the previous time, we go, well, let's try and come up with something that's more along those lines or plays on that joke or plays on that theme. And just do more of it. And so our focus group is really the millions of people that are on Facebook on Australia or Instagram or TikTok or whatever.
When there's the chat, like, let's get a couple of girls and I'll hold a goat. Like, where does that chat come from? That's where I love the creativity of it. It's like, you do this and then I'll hold this, and people will just be going, why is he doing that? Because it links, that nothing links. So that's what people are loving, and people are going, far out, I have to keep watching now.
We just try and like the... like often some of the time is what's random or what's funny, exactly. Or like, what have we got? Like that we just think is a laugh. And sometimes, like, we're not funny at all. People go, what an idiot. And other times people go, oh, that's pretty funny, or he's still an idiot, or like whatever. But if like certain things like Up and Go or Fanta or the cars or the girls or these things, we've kept going because we get, when I say really good feedback, I don't mean that people go, oh, Tom, you do amazing ads, but we get really good feedback in terms of signups or comments or interaction with the ad.
And what about those pitch? Like, how is Fanta and Up and Go? Like, is it just one of you pitching it? And are there some that we haven't seen yet that you say a few fell flat? Are there some that you can give us that have pitched that you thought would be good that didn't end up going to it?
Yeah. Look, the reason for Fanta is we did an ad where we had all of these people in our office a year and a half ago, and we had a little pony in there, and the whole thing was about that you know me and you've known the family for a long time, you bet with me, and talking about we've got this great service and everyone cheers, and then I can't open the champagne bottle. Yeah. And then my grandfather, that turns to him and he cracks open a Fanta.
Yeah,
and then everyone cheers again. And he actually is now passed, my grandfather, but he did this ad just before he passed away. And we got such feedback about the Fanta, and he used to drink a Fanta at least one every day and just loved it. And so we just thought we'd keep the Fanta in.
It's good.
In our ads, you know, we've stuck with.
That's good. So let's go back. So a lot of people know that you're the guy on telly, you're the guy that takes bets, you're the guy that does form, but where did the young Tom grow up? School, did you play sport, study, all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, look, I went to school in North Sydney called Shaw, and it was really great school, and you were there?
Yeah, I was there as well, a couple of years. Yeah.
Oh, terrific. Yeah, well, probably the same as you. It's a, like, real sort of, like, sporty school, and, like, anything that I, like, whether it was basketball or tennis or rugby, to me, growing up as a kid, it wasn't about schoolwork, it was about playing sport, you know, and just hanging out with your mates and going out on the weekends. And I didn't really have any sort of thought about racing as an industry or really about career. Like, I think, I don't know if it was the same for you guys, but did that, like, week of work experience in, like, year 10 and went and worked at, one of my mates' dads worked at Merrill Lynch and worked in there. And I thought, they took me down to the Futures Exchange. I thought, oh, that's interesting. But I was more concerned about playing footy on the weekend or, like, going out on the weekend than anything like that. And then just sort of went and did commerce at Sydney Uni with all my mates were doing that, and that sort of seemed like the path. And then 6 months into that, my dad said, do you want to work at the races? And just that first day at the track, I saw the activity and the buzz and the money changing hands and the theatre of it, and I was like, wow, this. And from that minute, it was just a complete change of I completely went about turn and went, I'm really interested in this. Why? How come I didn't know about this? And with the excitement, and it was like a big game of, but high level stakes of, and I loved it. I just, from that minute, I sort of went, how can I make sure I do this all the time and be around the racetrack and my dad and my grandfather as much as possible.
Like you said, that your family is always involved in racing. You said, you know, I was playing sport and doing whatever, going on the weekends. You looked at there, and I think I read you went and held a bag for one day or something. But did you ever not think of going down the other path with your mum, like horse training? Did you ever think of that?
No, because my mum would
all the early mornings
From the age of 12, she made me work every holidays at least 1 week going to the track with her at, like, I don't know, 3 o'clock or 2:30, whatever time it was. She went to the track, and that was a real bugger on my social life, you know. I was like, this is no good, because all my friends were out all night, and I was like, not at 12, but as we got into like 15, 16, 17 and all that sort of stuff, I was like, I don't want to be up so early. And then that would go from, you get there at 3 in the morning and work till, like, let's say 9, come home and like rest, and then you'd be back at the stables at midday to work that afternoon shift. And I was like, this is just this is no good. And then every Sunday I'd be at the stables and do the owners there, and I sort of went, this is hard. It's a hard job. It's you've got to be very dedicated. It's a very different lifestyle to have to be up so early in the morning, and it's a real labor of love. And I just didn't have that passion or love for. I used to ride. Like I rode a couple of days a week, and used to go to horse riding camps and go to gymkhanas and pony club. I loved horse riding, but I went, I'm not into I didn't have that passion for the actual training side of it. And because I didn't have the passion, I was like, oh, well, I'm just not interested in racing at all. But then when I saw the other side, the betting side, I was like, actually, this is really exciting. And it's not to say, like, I look and I'm in awe of the likes of my mum and the other trainers on what they're able to achieve and do and what they do for the industry. I'm completely in awe of it. It just wasn't my calling at all.
So when you went and had to did a couple of days out there and holding the bag, what was it like seeing those, I guess, alphas? So we hear people putting 20 bucks in here and there, but seeing some of the big wigs walking past and you see that money exchanging hands, were you just like, that's a lot of 50s I've never seen?
Yeah, I was used to seeing money. My dad always, obviously, growing up as a bookie and being around the track, I was used to seeing cash, but I wasn't used to seeing this theatre of, I used to love, the lines of, the likes of Sean and Kingsley Bartholomew. They were only young blokes back then, but when I first got to the races, they'd run down, they sort of split going down the bookies ring, and they just yell out to the bookies, to win whatever you want, to win whatever you want, to win whatever you want, win whatever. And I was like, to win whatever you want? What? Like, is that 100,000 or 5,000? And the bookies were like, oh, no, to win five, or win 10 right. maybe. But it was just such theatre of basically challenging the bookies and the whole probability side of, I used to see how much form my dad did in putting his, brains and thoughts about a race and going up against other people that could also win it at betting and it was the theatre of those professional punters and the bookies that I found so interesting, and the changing of the market and that how that group of smart punters could get it so right, and that bookies had to basically tiptoe through them not to lose too much to them and to be able to win on the day, and that you could lose huge amounts of money. You could lose and just be like, oh, this is the end of the world. And then 10, 15, 20, 40 minutes later, you could be back winning a lot of money. It was just a roller coaster. It was like playing high stakes cards and I used to play not a lot of cards, but I grew up with a man that lived to 102, and I used to live with him a couple nights a week as I grew up. And we used to play cards as kids, only for 1, 2 cent, 5 cent coins sort of stuff. But and he used to always say, oh, small fish are sweet. Well, I suddenly went from this wasn't a small fish, but they were betting in huge numbers. And I just loved it, working with my dad and learning from him. And then also with my grandfather, someone who was completely different and such a big gambler. And being around that was, it was so much fun.
With the question, I was going to leave this question until a bit later, but like you just said about high stakes cards, so I know poker really well, and any professional poker player will say you need to distance yourself away from money. Yes, you're dealing in chips and they're worth cash, but if you're thinking about the money you're playing with, you're not going to be making the right optimal decisions and sort of stuff, right? So as a bookie and as a young kid, I guess as well, where, you know, your mates are working at Macca's and doing whatever and studying, they're, you know, working for $10 an hour, and all of a sudden you've got to be responsible for a big amount of cash. You need to sort of distance yourself about the risk factor as well. You've got to be a big risk taker, right?
Yeah, you're 100% right. And it took me a bit of time to actually understand that exact point, in that we would go to the races with my grandfather, and we would lose, could lose $1 million in the space of 10, 20 minutes, huge betting. And then we go home from Randwick and he wouldn't want to go under the tunnel, like the distributor bit, to get back to North Sydney because there was a toll on there.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, but that's I don't know what the toll was at the time, yeah, but let's say call it $5.
Yeah.
I'm like, but we just lost, or we won huge figures, like could have lost $1 million. Yeah. And you want to take a detour not to go through that tunnel. And he was hard and tough. When on the racetrack, he thought of money completely differently. It was, is this the right bet? Are we betting the right person? Are we taking at the right odds? Are we doing the right thing? And they were sort of thought of as units. And then when you're off the racetrack, a dollar was a dollar, you know? So we went for, when we lost that $2 million on Derby Day in 2008, we all went to some nice restaurant because it was the first time that I was a bookie from New South Wales. I've worked in Victoria for 40 years since he was a bookie there in 1968. And we had a big evening dinner. He's like, oh, I'm not eating in that restaurant. It's too expensive. And had like a hot dog and a Fanta in the food court. And he was very hard and tough, you know, with money. Didn't buy, like had the same suit that he wore for 20 years, same shoes, like, not a coat of paint on the office, like really hard and tough, same car, like secondhand car from like, I don't know, 20 years or something, was very hard and tough. But on the racetrack, he thought of money completely differently. And I think that is, there's a lot of merit to that, because you've got to think about what is the most optimal decision from a gambling point of view and from a business point of view. And if there's such unbelievable numbers, if you start thinking, oh my gosh, that's, I can't do that, well, you're not going to be making the optimal decisions. And yeah, it took me a while to realize. And I really appreciated working with him in that he was such a big gambler, but also really taught me the value of money. And in startup land, is that it's very easy to spend money and go broke because your costs will exceed your revenue, is having that very lean mentality and operating in a very lean manner has been such a great lesson and really helped me in business down the track.
A story I heard that you've said before was, I think you must have been starting out and worried about going broke, was a bet you took from John Singleton, I think, and then you lost a stack and you thought, fuck, it's the end of the world. I'm finished. It's been good. Tell us about that bet and what you were doing then to take that.
So we, John Singleton had this horse, Bel de Jour, and my dad really didn't like it on form. And obviously we'd heard of, like, not of my dad, my grandfather knew John Singleton well, but I'd heard of John Singleton as a big, big punter. And we were just starting out as a partnership, my grandfather and myself, and we're on the worst stand in at the races in the interstate. And I saw him walking across, I think to Harry Barrett or one of the interstate bookies on the rails. And I just ran over to him. I said, oh, Mr. Singleton, Tom and my grandfather, Bill is over there. Look, we're top odds, your horse. And if you want to back it, you can get the best odds with us and love to offer you a great service. And we were only, obviously my grandfather would have taken any bet, but we were just starting out. We were holding maybe $3,000, $5,000 a day in the outer. And he goes, oh, yep, you guys are 10 to 1. Yeah, I'll have $10,000 on it. So to win $100,000. And I'd never taken a bet like that ever before. And it won the race. And so we did $10,000 on the day $100,000 on the day. And we could win or lose. If it was a great day, maybe $1,000 or $2,000. And to lose $100,000, I'm like, well, that's a year or 2 years or whatever down the drain. And my grandfather was so positive about it. He's like, look, it's a great lesson because once you bet someone to win $100,000, you've reached that milestone. And to bet big, you've got to build conditioning because you can't go to the races or a card game or anything and play ultra high stakes because, as you mentioned before, that emotion will get in your way. You need to be used to betting in those amounts that it just becomes – you're thinking about it rationally. And he goes, once you get to that size and you learn what it's like to take a bet to win $100,000 and you can stomach the loss of it, you'll be able to take bets that size regularly, and then you'll move up. And it was true. Within a 5-year period, we went from being the smallest bookie on the outer in, on the interstate to being the biggest on-course bookies in Australia. We were turning over $6 million a day and winner losing millions of dollars. You know, it was a huge change. And really that and one of the other big punters that we had on board very early really changed my mentality about betting and betting big. To me, when I first started to lose $200, it was unthinkable to me, you know, and it's funny how it changes and changed thanks to my grandfather and obviously the support of my dad and my grandfather.
So your grandfather, you know, everyone knows him, but did he come out to teach you about being a bookie? Because to me, he would have been a bit old school. You would have been the young, brash, bit cocky, coming in thinking, you know, what young fellas are like. What was that? Did you guys clash at all?
Yeah, so he came back as an 80-year-old to teach me bookmaking. And we fought like cat and dog for 5 years, like every day. We never fought at the races, but he would just give it to me afterwards going, what were you doing here? What did you do here? Because I started as a bookie learning from my dad. And my dad is a form genius and he would do 6 hours of form before the races and have a very strong opinion. And he wouldn't want to lay the horses that he liked, and he wanted to back the horse he liked, and he wanted to lay the ones he didn't like. He was very opinionated and very, and rightfully so, of how he wanted the book and to look like. When my grandfather wanted to basically bet everyone and gamble big. And so I'd learned from my dad, and I thought that was the only way to be a bookie. And so I didn't want to bet if my dad liked something on form. I didn't want to be equal best odds and bet the next person to come over whatever they wanted. And we'd clash. And I was actually not wanting to bet big, wanting to bet very small. My grandfather was wanting to bet very big. And what he taught me is that if you want to build a big business and a big clientele, not every bet you take can be a great bet for you, you know, because if you say to a customer, look, oh, I'm only going to take this bet or that bet, or when you've got something in your favor, look, you can't get on, you can't have that. Well, that's not great customer service. You've got to take a punter has to wet their beak occasionally, because if they lose all the time and take the worst odds all the time and take the ones you don't like, they're going to get pretty sick of betting, aren't they? They've got to have an edge sometimes. And he basically said, look, if you take them all on and you keep betting and you keep consistently and you keep, you'll build a huge clientele and you're going to beat them all in the end anyway. And that, you need a big bankroll to be able to do that, because you have some pretty bad days and you need to be very consistent and disciplined. But he taught, it was really his lessons. He was very, I realized he was correct about nearly everything and wise, very wise, in that he, and the lessons he taught, we were able to build a very big business. You know, we could have had a much smaller business, maybe one higher percentage on turnover, but we would never have had the turnover that we got to, like, I don't know, turning over $300 million, $200, $300 million a year as an on-course bookie back then, 15 years ago. That's a big business in such a short period of time. And to have these big punters and to get the group of big punters that we had every big punter, maybe not every big punter, but I felt like any big punter you heard of, they were coming to us first saying, look, can I back this to win 100,000 or 500,000 or whatever. And that, they sound like huge bets in today's period, because bet bookmaking and the amount you can get on has got a lot smaller. But we would just stomach them and take those bets. And that was really because he just kept beating it into me. Tom, you're doing the wrong thing. You've got to gamble. You've got to bet up. And luckily, I had so many advantages in that I had my dad and his knowledge and his form, the backing and the bankroll of obviously my dad and my grandfather.
Yeah.
And we had we were in an ability where we could take advantage of the new technology change. Like a lot of the bookies weren't in 2007, 2008, 2009. They weren't looking at what was happening on Betfair or what was happening on with the corporates. They were just treating it as though the way the on-course had been for 20 years before. And so we had a few advantages which able to enable us to accelerate quickly in that market.
You did phone betting, didn't you? I'm pretty sure before you mentioned Melbourne before. So that was 2008. There was a tax issue. So what was this? I don't know anything about that. So tell me about that first.
Yeah, so the taxes in New South Wales was the first state to increase the tax, race fields tax. And we moved down to Melbourne at the time because there was lower tax in Victoria at the time. And I had a license in Victoria. I used to go down before that for the Friday night meetings because they switched Friday nights in Sydney, I think, they switched to Friday nights in Melbourne and they were Thursday nights in Sydney. So I'd go to Canterbury on a Thursday night and then I had a license in Victoria, go on a Friday night to Moonee Valley. And then when the tax increased, I thought, well, why don't I just be a bookie all the time in Victoria and went down there. And really it changed the business dramatically because in Victoria you could offer a product called Best Tote and you couldn't offer that product in New South Wales at the time. And you could also have access to the internet and Betfair. So we had this telephone business and we could offer all these telephone clients that we had from Sydney, we could offer them this product called Best Tote, which was pretty good. They could bet tote with us. And we also could see what was happening in the market off course, which the bookies in Sydney at the time couldn't. So they didn't know that they were betting $4 and that was trading $3.50 on Betfair. And so it was and at the time, I think we had three or four bookies that would bet us every bet to win 100,000. So I had my dad's form. I had the biggest punters betting with us and also the smartest and the ability to trade off the business we didn't like and know what the exchange price was when a lot of the market didn't. It was a really interesting time. But obviously, whenever you've got an edge, that edge doesn't last long, you know, and the market changed and we had to adapt. And obviously that was the start of TomWaterhouse.com. We moved onto the internet and there are several other factors why we had to move onto the internet, being like 3G came out, iPhones came out, the advertising laws changed. But yeah, if with that edge, that was a great time, but obviously, yeah, any edge in any business doesn't last forever.
But yeah, you say that it's a lot about looking forward as well. And going to TomWaterhouse.com, it's such, even now, it's all online. You barely see bookies on track anymore. You saw that coming. Well, what was the move like to going to TomWaterhouse.com and then you having the name and getting your name out there, and even to a point where we started seeing you on all the sport, all the rugby league, the AFL. How did that all eventuate, and what was the main things you targeted when opening?
So 2008, I was on the rails at Flemington and holding more than all the other bookies on the rails combined at that time. We had some really big clients betting with us. And I remember the favourite for the Derby got 500,000 cash out of it in 2008. So it wasn't like 500,000 telephone bets, actual cash people betting. It was just a huge betting. And I thought, well, I'm in heaven. You know, this is what my grandfather did and was here 40 years before. And I'm living in Crowd Casino. And like every day I get to go to the races and basically play high stakes poker every day, and I've got an edge in that. I've got access to Betfair and I've got my dad's form and I've got all of that. I'm like, this, how good is this? I hope I'm doing this for the every day of my life forever. And Crown was just a magical place to live, and it was just so much fun. And then within 1 year, with all those changes, the money just dried up. You know, next year I was in the middle of the rails and in the Derby 2009, I got $5,000 out of the favorite being a rollover. It was $4 favorite. I was $4.20 or $4.40 and got $5,000 cash out. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this, what I loved, it's finished. It's gone. You know, like there is no money here. And this is Derby day. And so after Sandown meeting, I moved into the office full time, started up a telephone only business, and really started the workings of moving online to TomWaterhouse.com. And we didn't know. We just basically went, well, if we can just preserve our existing business by giving them an online offering, that would be terrific. And my mum was on TVN, and I went on one night with her, and we saw a spike in signups, and we're like, actually, this TV thing might work. And so let's, what's available for TV? And my brother-in-law was working at Channel 9, and they hadn't been able to sell the Rugby World Cup. And we ended up buying that at what they said was a discount. I have no idea if we actually, I hope my brother-in-law got me a discount, but we bought that, and we got quite a few signups out of that. And we thought, when actually, well, like maybe this live sport stuff works. And so we saw all these overseas businesses coming in, and we thought, well, if live sport works, there's only a bit of it. We need to buy as much as we can. And so we bought up as much of live sport as we possibly could. We bought up the regional AFL, regional NRL, the Metro, one spot in the Metro AFL, the tennis, Australian Open, regional, Wimbledon. And we sponsored an AFL team, and then the NRL, we thought, well, we need to get the NRL. And the NRL had exclusivity with the TAB, and went to David Gingell and met with him and said, look, how do we go about getting this? He said, look, the TAB's got it. They've got exclusivity. They have to renew it every year on this date. And I called him at 5 o'clock in the afternoon on that day and said, did they renew? He said, they haven't renewed yet. And I said, he goes, it's actually open. I said, well, look, how about we pay you $60 million over the next 5 years and we take it off your hands? And he said, yeah. And so we got the NRL and basically got all of this live sport in Australia, which was a very valuable asset. But
yeah, was there a lot of backlash from like TAB or whoever had that at the time? With that, hang on, who's this guy that's coming here and all of a sudden everywhere? Was there a bit of backlash from them? Because you went toe to toe with some big bookies, right? At this time,
yeah. So we just took a punt on the NRL. So it was all delayed settlement with the NRL. So it was $60 million over 5 years, but the bulk of the payments were in the last few years of the deal. And our punt was that we would be able to acquire enough customers that generated the business to where it looked like a good deal. It was significantly well above what TAB were paying previously. But in the scheme of period, all those sporting deals were very good deals to do. But the thing that I didn't appreciate, we barely got any backlash about the brand and when we were on the racing and promoting all these sports. But I remember they said, look, Tom, the deal for that amount was that 5 minutes before kickoff basically became tomwaterhouse.com time. Like we were going to talk about everything to do with betting and then it would finish up with me talking about betting and then it would be kickoff. And I know that sounds insane now in today's thing that you could have 5 minutes of talking about betting or whatever,
yeah.
But that was the deal. And there hadn't been any backlash really before that. So I guess they thought maybe we can do that. But I have no experience on TV and no experience with NRL. I hadn't watched any NRL since I was a kid, like when Alfie Langer and all of those sort of players were playing. And I never watched anything of it. And they said, look, you better come in for a test run. And I went and gave it a bit of a go, a test run with Steve Crawley there, the guy that ran all the sport for them. And he said, look, Tom, in all my time in television, I've never seen anyone with less talent than you. And look, there's no way you can be on the TV for 5 minutes before NRL kicks off. And so that really came about. They go, look, to ease you in, we'll put you on the panel. And at least when you forget what you're talking about or whatever, we can help you along the way.
Yeah.
And that was really... I think the backlash was a few things. One of them more, why is this young sort of upstart guy thinks that he can talk to us and tell us all about NRL when he knows nothing about it? And why is he annoying us on TV? Secondly, is he trying to pretend he's a commentator? What are they doing there? And also, well, why do we need to have gambling just before we're about to watch our footy, like when we're sitting down with our kids and our family? But what they were trying to actually do, because I was such a poor talent on TV, was a big backlash point. And really the backlash really started on the brand then. But the business really accelerated. Like that deal, our signups went through the roof. And
I was one of
really, really taught me like that just because it's not necessarily positive feedback, it doesn't mean it's not good for growing your business and growing the brand. But yeah, it was a whirlwind, and I was very much in the shooting line of, or in the firing line, on many different fronts in that 2013. It was quite a wild roller coaster year, because we had the NRL and the backlash, and then there was a Senate inquiry into gambling where there was the More Joyous inquiry. Yeah. There was and also selling the businesses, and my wife had our first child, you know, so it was a sort of a 6 month period of absolute turmoil and wildness and a roller coaster ride. But it was a really great learning experience and life experience at the time as well.
There's a big thing as well that you've said before, that it's big in England that all these bookmakers put their name to it, and it never happened in Australia as well. You were the first to go, all right, this is Tom Waterhouse. So not only is your face out there being part of it, it's your name. Mm. And so I think a big part of it as well would have been everyone has you as the focal point. It's not like Sportsbet or business. Tab, they're a business. People think, all right, yeah. TomWaterhouse.com, it's you. You're the reason, you're that. But that's part of bookmaking as well. Like it wasn't being done at that point.
Yeah, well, I know as a kid, I used to, when I go to the races, the bookie that I'd want to bet with was Cole Tidy, because I'd heard of Cole Tidy.
Yeah.
And I didn't look to see if he was the best odds. I know that probably sounds so stupid. Maybe I was just a dumb kid. But I was like, oh, no, I'm just going to bet with Cole Tidy because I've heard of him. And I just didn't get why all of these businesses were becoming these sort of generic names. And yeah, we had a big advantage in, obviously, the family was really well known and having a face to it and a name to it. But that comes with its huge advantages. But also there's the flip side to that. And you see that with a lot of companies which have got a person that runs them or someone that's founded them that becomes the face of it. They cop a lot of heat. But if you want the benefit of being able to grow your business quickly and having that where you're easily identifiable and the business can benefit off that, you've got to take the flip side. And I was conscious of the negative side of it, especially this next time going to business with the brand that can happen.
So you sold your business to William Hill, and I'm assuming you had like a small interest as well, but then I'm assuming you can't compete with them. There has to be some time on the sidelines. Is that right? Once you sell the business?
William Hill bought TomWaterhouse.com and I was in an earnout for what was supposed to be a few years, but we ended up ending the earnout within a year. Okay. Because they bought Sportingbet, Centrebet and TomWaterhouse.com. TomWaterhouse.com was a slight add-on. Like they paid, I think, $700 million for Sportingbet and Centrebet, and we were just an add-on later, really, because we were acquiring customers so cheaply.
Yeah.
But the global CEO on the board said, look, we bought these businesses. And I used to write to the global CEO, maybe only once a month, but I'd say, look, really, because I wanted the earnout to go as well as possible. Look, I think that to get the best out of these businesses you bought, this is how I would see them growing as possible. These are the things that I would do if it was just TomWaterhouse.com. Not like you're not doing this or this isn't working properly, but just look, you may not be interested, but these are the things that I think would be of benefit for this business to accelerate. And after 6 months and a few of these letters, he said, well, look, how about we end your earnout and you run this company for us in Australia? And I'd never had a job before. You know, I was an on-course bookie and TomWaterhouse.com, and to sort of be given the reins of this sort of $700 million, $2.5 billion turnover business, I was like, oh, well, that's pretty exciting. My family, like, what are you thinking? Get out of there as quickly as possible. Go back into your own business. Do all this sort of stuff. No one in the family has had a job I don't know how many generations. They've all been sort of sole traders or have built businesses and stuff like that. But I had such a great time and really enjoyed William Hill and learned so much from being part of a sort of a big multinational business like the Australian business. We had offices in Tel Aviv and the Philippines and all over Australia. And it was just really interesting to learn how a big company works and what they do well and also what they don't do as well. You know, like there's big positives being in a big company and there's also some negatives.
Yeah. So you've acquired the name back and you started your business. Let's talk about your business now. So you're a tipping service, but you also have like an odds comparison, which, you know, I looked at, there was another website a while ago that used to have that as well. But you've sort of always been in the game of taking bets and making money from people that have lost money, right? Or they lose their money. That's how you're a bookie. But now you're helping people make money. So is it a bit of a different shift for you?
Yeah, look, the reason being is that William Hill, when they sold to the Stars Group, I was able to buy the TomWaterhouse.com brand back, but on the condition I didn't go into betting for 2 years. And I just thought, well, look, my dad is a professional punter and he's taught me these lessons of how to win punting. And most people don't view punting. They want to win, obviously, like, but they view it as entertainment. And a little bit like me as a kid betting with Cole Tardy, I didn't care whether it was 420 or $4. I just wanted to bet with Cole Tardy. They don't know the importance of getting the top price, of having that discipline of around a staking plan, of doing the form and analysing which horse to back and why you're backing it and where there's an edge or where there's not an edge. And I just thought maybe these lessons that my dad had taught me that there was a big market for it. And so that's how the tipping business started. And then what evolved is that the biggest complaint we got from our tipping members was, look, Tom, you say you offer these tips and these returns, but these prices that you're quoting, you can't get them. How do I ever get them? And I'm like, well, do you have accounts with all 21 corporates? Do you have them all funded? Do you have are you on dynamic odds? Are you on? And they're like, no, I have an account with the TAB or I have an account with Sportsbet. And I'm like, oh, well, that's really good. It's good to have an account with them, but you need to also have lots of accounts and you need to make sure you're always getting the top price. And this was just constant feedback all the time. And so I really went down the path of, well, how can I make it easy for our members that are coming to our app that they can easily get the tips and then place them on at the best price? And that really started the conversations about with dynamic odds and bet makers and how can we utilize their technology. And they've done such an amazing job for punters. Like, I've used dynamic odds for years and just went, what a great product. How can I leverage off what they've done and their great work they've done to give that same experience to our members inside an app? And that was really the conversation of how it started and how we got into not only tipping but an odds aggregator or odds comparison business.
So you've got, it is like a, I guess it is a long-term strategy where discipline is, you know, at the forefront. And that can be a card game as well when you think about it. You know, there's variants you come through and it's a long-term strategy. But I talk to some pro punters as well, and they now say things like, I could win 10 grand in a day or I could win $10. And at the end of the day, I just want to know that I'm winning and I'm making a profit. But at the end of the day, a lot of Australians, we just punt on Saturdays and we just want to win big on Saturday. You know, I want to deposit my 100 and I'm stoked if I take out 500 or whatever. Your model, you want to gradually just increase that on over and over. So you don't really have to market to those, I guess. You've got a different market. You're not marketing to the D-gens that want to just punt hard on a Saturday and win big.
Look, what's interesting is that it's caters. People are interested for lots of, there's people that go, actually, I love punting and I'm going to sit there all day Saturday into the last at Perth and I'm going to be on Betfair. I'm have all the corporates, I'm having Tom's, and I'm going to just do it as though I'm professional. And if I can eke out 10% profit on turnover at the end of the year, I'm so happy because I've done what I love and I've been able to win at it. Yeah. And then there's other people, actually, one of my best mates does this. He gets like our five best tips on a Saturday and he actually goes, well, I'm going to do better just backing those five tips than I would picking them out myself because I haven't got time to do the form. But he bets only with – actually, he only bets with Sportsbet. You know, he doesn't have an account with anyone else.
Yeah.
And I'm like, use the Odds Aggregator app and have a counsel. And he's like, oh, I can't be bothered. And look, at the end of the year, I'm just having a, I just want to have a punt and enjoy it. And I'm like, I'm happy to be on your tips because I've got to pick something out anyway. And I just want to watch a few races through the Saturday. And if I win, great. If I don't, and it's an entertainment thing for him. And that's fine. You know, like if hopefully by using our selections and our staking and you do better than what you would have done, then you'll be, our whole mission is to make you a better. And so if you're better and you don't lose as much as you would have lost before, or you win because you're following it very from a disciplined approach, both are good. And both, like, I don't, there's no like disrespect to one of my best mates. That's what he wants. Like, there's nothing wrong with me going to the, like, to the movies and going, well, I'm going to spend $50 tonight with my, me and my wife, go to the movies, have a chop top, relax. And I'm not going to the lowest cost movie cinema or whatever. I just go, well, that's my entertainment. I've got a lot of benefit out of that. And if someone, like the average punter loses $400 a year, that's $8 on average a week. So $8. So it's the lowest cost form of entertainment. Basically, I don't know of any lower cost. You go to the pub with your mates, you're going to spend more than $8 on average a week. You go to the movies, you're going to spend more than $8 a week. You're going to go shopping, you know, more than that. You get a lot of bang for your buck out of punting. And if your goal is, it takes a lot of time and effort to win. And if your goal is like, actually, I just want to enjoy it, that's also fine. There's not like, you don't have to be the Sean Bartholomew or the Jelko or the Rob Waterhouse to be, to go, oh, well, they're the only people for the tips. It's if it improves your entertainment and you're getting a bit more knowledge and being better at it, it's also good.
So you've got, on your side, you've got, you know, different, you've got silver package and you're all the way up to like $100,000 a year. How are you personally now doing any of the form yourself, or have you got a bunch of traders and you sort of do it together?
No, it's all automated, but there's manual oversight. Yeah. So like the real thought process is, how do we come up with factors? Because you can have an automated model that have, I'll call it 10 factors just for simplicity, 10 factors in it. But in 5 years, the market is going to realize that those factors have got an edge. Like people have jerried on 7-day backups or horses with like certain gear change or a certain trainer jockey combination.
Yeah.
And so for Saturday, is it, oh, well, I'm going to do 20 hours of form specifically on that meeting? No, but is it understanding, okay, well, these factors are evolving and what are new factors that the market aren't picking up? And then understanding, okay, in this automated or computerized model, where could it have got wrong? What is not in the model that conditions have changed? Like there's big winds or there's they've watered a certain part of the track or they've moved the barrier like out a certain way or the start's different. Like that. So, but it's really over time of making sure your models it is adapting and keeping pace. Because if you have the same model that you had 10 years ago or 20 years ago, I've seen winning punters that haven't realized that the market has adapted and they have turned from being really big winning punters to big losing punters because they thought they had a form system that could beat the market and the market adapted.
Yeah.
All the bookies adapted.
Yeah. It's pretty interesting. I find it fascinating that you've gone the completely opposite. So how do I do it without booking? I'm going to make a tipping service. And you also, you know, you say if you don't make a profit on that week, I'll give you your money back. So that's a little bonus too. We've got a lot of questions as well sent in from questions for you. One person, we've sort of covered this a little bit, but they said, as a family man, how do you handle copping shit? And does your wife get protective, or does she look at those ads and say, what are you doing? Why are you holding a goat? Or does she have any input going, Tom, you're an idiot, or anything like that?
I think she definitely goes, Tom, you're an idiot sometimes, but she directs a lot of the ads. So she comes to all our shoots and really, if she goes, oh, no, that's too, like some of the ideas that like we come up with in here or the team comes up with, they're like so out there. And she's definitely like, there's no way we're doing that or no way you're doing it. But some of the stuff that we think is just hilarious or just completely just a joke, some people think, oh, that's dreadful, how could you do that? And other things we think are really edgy, no one makes any comment about. And so I think that, yeah, from her point of view, she realizes that it's marketing. You know, it's trying to build a brand and trying to get noticed and trying to get people to be part and take a look at the business. And yeah, she's obviously, like, in my life, my family, my wife, my kids, and the broader family are number one in my life. So if she didn't feel comfortable, was appropriate, I wouldn't be doing it, you know? So, but yeah, it's also, it's all, we just try and have fun with it, you know? And not, when you're putting yourself out there, if you're vanilla, it will never work. You know, you have to have to create where people want to talk or water cooler conversation. There has to be a difference of opinion. You know, no one, if everyone agrees that such and such is right, well, there's no point having a conversation about it because, okay, well, yeah, we agree and that's it. But if someone goes, oh, I think those ads are awful and oh, they're amazing, or how funny is that? They're not funny, that's disgraceful. That's interesting because people have a conversation and there's a difference of opinion, and that talkability is obviously leads to your brand being talked about and noticed.
Another question, someone asked, why the suits 24/7?
Yeah, so it's funny. I think it's when I was a kid, I just always wanted to dress and look like my dad or my grandfather, you know, like I always like was way overdressed as a kid. I wore my dad's clothes. Like I used to wear my dad's suit with like a clip on it, like around the waist, yeah, and clips on the races and stuff. And I remember my best mate growing up, I went to his house at maybe like 10 or 12, and I'd come like in maybe like suit slack, like slacks and
yeah,
maybe no tie, but I was like, as a 12-year-old, extremely well-dressed, like, and all in my dad's gear. And the mum goes to, and he's in his trackies and like a hoodie and stuff. And I walk in and I'd be like, oh, Mr. and Mrs. And then look, to me, he's like, look, don't you think you should dress a little bit more like Tom? Like, look how smart he looks. And he's like, mum, he's 12. He's a weirdo. Like, why would I dress like him? He's a complete weirdo. And I guess I've always dressed like that, you know. And
yeah,
I don't know. Maybe as I'm getting older, I joke, like, I've always wanted to try and look older. And maybe now that I am getting older, maybe I'll start dressing, trying to look like you know, like so
your dad might be boardies and or sluggos or something.
Yeah, maybe you're boardies for the next dad's in the next few years.
Another one. If you didn't grow up with the family you have, or if racing and wagering stops tomorrow, how are you earning a crust? What would you want to be doing?
Well, the area that we're really focusing on at the moment is in the investment side, and focusing this opening up of the US gambling sector is just growth area. And the area that we focus on is in the businesses that provide services to the bookmaking businesses. So we're into businesses that provide, let's say it's data or vision or marketing tools, casino products, games, anything that provides the services to the gambling companies. And the analysis of that and trying to find where there's an edge in the market and then being disciplined around how much you stake or how much you invest is so interesting, and great parallels with the betting and gambling space. And that's taking up a lot of time and focus. The investment space, not investment space broadly, because I don't feel I've got any edge in the broader investment space, is just focusing on mainly listed gambling companies or businesses that are related to the gambling sector.
How big do you think sports betting in America is going to be? Like, I think we've just sort of started tapping into it, but where do you think it's going to end up?
Oh, like, I think conservatively 10x Australia, you know? So I think it's just the beginning, you know? And, like, you're seeing these businesses there, and the whole ecosystem is, you've got the big, like, whether it's like the Flutters, FanDuel, DraftKings, Penn State, William Hill, like Caesars, MGM, PointsBet, all of these companies, like, they look like they're all going to go great and grow over the next 5-10 years. But all the businesses that are connected with them, like the likes of like Playtech and BetMakers and SportsRadar and BetGenius, and then all the marketing businesses, like the likes of Fox and NBC and Facebook and Google and the CRM tools like Adobe, and like all of these like different businesses that connect into this industry that's really just about to explode in growth. They're just also, it's just so interesting. And we're lucky coming from Australia, because that opening up happened 20 years ago here for us. And we've seen that 20 years of what it looks like, and the consolidation, the growth, and the marketing war, and all of this stuff that happens. It's really interesting. And yeah, I really enjoy the time I spend focusing on that. Yeah.
Where do you think it's going to go in Australia then, Tom? Like, it looks like we're going to eventually be one toe. Bigger bookmakers are buying up smaller ones. Are we going to go down the track in 5-10 years? Are we going to have 3 main bookmakers, or are we going to have 50? What do you sort of see happening in the next few years for Australia?
Look, it's a guess, or maybe an educated guess, because yeah. Like, so many times I've gone, oh, this is the end of racing, or this is the end of sport, or this is the end of that. And sure enough, like, things change that you didn't expect, and suddenly it's a growth period and things are going great. And so you can never get it right. But if I had to, I'd say that at the big end, like the big sort of turnover bookies, there's going to be continued consolidation. Like you've seen that. Look at the big bookies like Sporting Bet and the Centre Bet and Crown Bet, and like that's all just one deal. Like now but what I've been surprised with is, and I think that there's a long runway for more of this to occur, is there's now a very long tail of smaller bookies, and that have gone, well, actually, I understand bookmaking and I used to be on course, but now with COVID, I have to go online. And you're seeing a long tail of these bookies like robwaterhouse.com, Real Bookie, like you're seeing like BBet, Warren Woodcock. There's a stack of these smaller bookies that offer a great service. They're very competitive with odds, and they cater to a different segment of the market. And I think that's fantastic. And I think both can exist. I actually don't think they cause that much bother for the big bookies that are playing a different sort of game. And I think they can carve out a nice niche part of the market. And for those punters that are searching for really good odds and want to put the time in to get lots of accounts and all that, that's a nice addition for them also.
What did it mean as a family winning the TJ with Shamika and Bentley Biscuit?
Oh, I think like that's going back a little bit of time, but yeah, he's such an amazing man. Obviously, my grandfather TJ, and anything that's anything that relates to him, and I know how much my mum gets out of stuff when she can win either the TJ that's named after him, or equaling or getting close to his records, like the number of Metropolitan winners in a season. It was a huge thing for him, and equal the amount of Golden Slippers that he trained. Just huge things, and especially for her because she idolises her father, you know, and my grandfather TJ, and she just idolises him, and similarly, how I've learned everything from my dad and my grandfather, she learned everything from him. And that's very special. I guess probably the most special moment, though, was her winning the Melbourne Cup, because the enjoyment that she got out of it, and also my dad helping her find the horse, and just how much happiness that brought. And it's such a big thing to win the Melbourne Cup, and was a lifelong goal for her. That was a huge, huge thing for the family.
All right. So after my little blackout, the question I asked was, what was the biggest bet you ever took or won or lost? I know people always want to hear this sort of stuff. So tell me.
At the call of the card, we took bets to lose $2-3 million. In terms of, I think the biggest bet on something, it felt like that someone had like $500,000 on New Zealand to win the Rugby World Cup against France. I thought they were going to lose that.
Far out. That was close.
Yeah. And, but I don't know. They're like probably the biggest bets. Like I remember going to lose nearly $500,000 on a race at Wyong.
Wow.
And I thought that was a huge bet because it was such a small meeting and you don't hold anywhere near that. So like if you're holding to lose a couple million dollars on Melbourne Cup, you're sort of betting in that sort of size that you can absorb it. Where if you lose on a Thursday at Wyong, that sort of amount, it's, but one particular bet, I can't think of the biggest. I remember when Viewed won the Melbourne Cup. I don't know if we won the most on that, but it felt like such a relief because we'd lost the $2 million on the Derby Day the day before, and to get such a long shot to win the Cup was a great result.
See, this is funny to me because you've just talked astronomical numbers, but then you look back and you were shitting yourself when you lost 100 to Singleton. So, like,
yeah, it's
changed.
Yeah, and also I think like the first meeting I went to as a bookie, I think it was like Come By Chance race meeting, and to lose like $100 there was just, I was like so beside myself. I'm like, I can't believe that could happen. But it's just what you get used to, and also the volume that you're betting in. You know, like if you're winning or losing $100,000 a race, well then to lose $100,000 is not much because you can win that back in 20 minutes or 40 minutes. But if you've never bet any size before, no one likes losing any money. You know, it's if you said to a kid that you've lost $20, they're beside themselves. You know, it's just, it's what you get used to and you condition yourself for.
Do you punt yourself? And do you have a favourite race that you've punted on in the past, or a race in general, or a track?
Look, I only bet when I believe that there's an edge over the market. I don't go to like a casino and
play roulette.
Just have a flutter. Like, it's not to say I haven't gone to a table like with a whole group of guys and mates and just like, but I don't go that. I don't get enjoyment out of that, or I don't go on like next to jump and go, oh look, which name's nice, you know, or like. But if there's an edge in a market, the only one where I probably, well, I don't have any edge, but I like to bet is I love like backing a younger player against an older player when the younger player's got a better head-to-head record and they're longer odds than the older player in tennis. And I have not done any of the like analysis on whether that actually works out or whatever, but I love going to the tennis, and I might have a bet if I'm going to the tennis and that criteria fits, you know, like, but I wouldn't take those factors at all because I put no thought, proper analysis into it. But I always think I have to have an edge and be getting top odds to have a bet. Actually, one other time I had a bet was on the recent Gallen fight.
Did you back Gallen?
This really smart punter. He's like, this is the biggest moral of all time to have this bet or something like that. I can't even remember which one I backed, but
Mark
I still search.
You're fighting Mark Hunt?
Yeah, I've
everyone said he was going to get killed.
Yeah, whatever it was is that I made sure I got the top odds and it was a small bet. But I'm not I always have to feel I have an edge for me to bet.
Have you ever done something opposite to sort of what your traders have said, even in the early days or even when you were a bookie? So when you you thought probably shouldn't be going this high or this odds or whatever, and you've sort of just gone out on a limb? Or are you strictly just like, you know, algorithm based like what you are now?
No, I think the times that have caught me off guard when you really want to win a new punter's business, you know, and the likes of John Singleton, or I remember a Nathan Tinkler, like when he was like had horses running and like first starters and might be a first starter at Sandown that's never raced before.
Yeah.
And he wants a big bet on a horse that's never raced, never had any form. And you're like, I wouldn't hold any money on this race, but you don't want to say to someone like that or a John Singleton, no, I'm not going to take the bet. You bet far bigger than you would feel comfortable betting. And it's all about betting at the appropriate size for the occasion. And betting on a Sandown maiden on a Wednesday to lose a few hundred thousand is definitely not in proportion to what you could win in those meetings. So that's probably where I've stepped outside of what is a comfort zone or what is appropriate size to bet.
So because I wasn't going to ask this, but you've mentioned it a couple of times, is cards. So I'm assuming you're talking poker. You play poker?
Very poorly. But yeah, I do. I do play poker. Like, again, if I'm with mates or if I'm trying to stay up late at night to catch a plane back somewhere or something, I'll play poker. But again, I've got no edge playing poker.
Nah, but you enjoy it. So that people like, that's what I'm talking about. So people like punting, but they're not scared to lose, right? But they also, they don't want to lose all the time. So in poker, when I was talking about, you know, when you don't want to think about money, yes, there's that little plastic chip on the table, but that's really worth $1,000, right? You need to distance yourself from it. So I was just thinking, like, even when you play cards, you're not going to keep going back if you keep doing your ass, right? And you keep getting beat, because that's not fun. So if you were to win, or the good players, the Sharks or whatever, were there to allow you to win, which is probably what happens majority of the time in casinos for pro poker players, they probably let these guys come in and win every now and then. But do you like in the enjoyment of cards? Like, I love poker. I've gone down to Crown times and gone there. Even if you lose, you know, everyone's got a sick beat. Yes, you can get done in a photo finish in a horse race, but it doesn't compare to losing with aces pre-flop to some idiot's 5-6 of spades, correct?
Yeah, I love cards. I don't play, especially now that I'm married with kids, I don't play often. But yeah, it's great. It's a lot of fun, and it's a mental game. It's a social game.
Yeah.
Anyone
can go sit down. That's a cool thing about it too.
Yeah, correct.
Yeah. Awesome, mate. Thank you for joining me. Sorry I had a little blackout mid interview, but I love what you're doing. I like the tipping service. I like how you're doing it completely. You're there for the punter now, and you put out your tips and you put your money where your mouth is, and you give refunds when you're not making a profit. I love it. So, and I love the marketing, mate. So keep that up as well.
Really appreciate it. Hopefully you like the new ads.
Mate, they're out this weekend?
Yeah. The first one's out this weekend.
Beautiful. Thanks, Tom.
All right. Good to see all of us. Thanks, Zach.
Bye. Buddy.
If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your mates or share it on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and you can find us at Give Us A Spell Pod. Feel free to get in touch with us. We love hearing from our listeners and having a chat with you. If it's anything about sport or racing or a punt that you had, you won or lost, we love hearing it. If you haven't left a review yet on Apple Podcasts or on Facebook, please do. It does wonders for us growing the show. And there's plenty in our archives from previous interviews from all the stars in rugby and racing, so be sure to check those out. Happy punting.